However much our commander-in-chief likes to deny the reality of the climate crisis, his military is preparing for it.
In Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia, there'll be massive storms, droughts, and floods, fires, as we've seen in Australia. And this will create a massive chaos, pandemics, the collapse of nations, mass migrations. And this, they believe, will require constant U.S. military intervention abroad.
That's Michael Clare. We talked with him about his new book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. Then we air a clip from our 2011 interview with Christian Parenti about his book, Tropic of Chaos. We also review a terrific new thriller from Hillary Davidson. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Like us on Facebook, Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon. Or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. With its generally conservative politics, the Pentagon might not seem likely to be worried about climate change. Yet of all the major institutions in American society, none takes the climate crisis as seriously as the U.S. military. Both as participants in climate-triggered conflicts abroad and as first responders to hurricanes and other disasters on American soil, the armed services are already confronting the impacts of global warming. The military now regards climate change as one of the top threats to American national security, and it's busy developing strategies to cope with it. In his new book, All Hell Breaking Loose, renowned security expert Michael Clare shows that the U.S. military sees the climate threat as imperiling the country on several fronts at once. Droughts and food shortages are stoking conflicts in ethnically divided nations, while climate refugees suffer backlashes and xenophobia. And rising seas threaten American cities and military bases themselves. Michael Clare is the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies in Amherst, Massachusetts. He's the author of several books, including Blood and Oil and Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. So this book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change, it's a terrifying look at the world we are going into, and it's a look from the point of national security in a very important way, and talking about national security in a way that we don't often talk about it. You write in the book about a 2018 Department of Defense report on climate-related risk to defense infrastructure. What have we already seen in terms of impacts on infrastructure on our defense?
Well, let's bear in mind that so many American military bases are located at the coast. Now, that makes sense because we depend a lot on our Navy to project power overseas and our Air Force to carry troops overseas. So a large part of the military infrastructure in the U.S. is located either on the eastern seaboard of the U.S. or on the western coast of the United States. And those areas are very vulnerable to sea level rise and to extreme storm activity, and on the west coast to wildfires. And indeed, in the past few years, we've seen very intense storms in the Atlantic that have severely destroyed some U.S. facilities. And we've also seen fires in the West Coast that have attacked American bases there. So just in the past few years, we've seen tremendous effects of climate change on U.S. military infrastructure.
So that report was released in January 2018, but a later draft cut out a lot of things that were in the earlier draft. What are some of the things that were cut out, and why were they cut out of the report?
Well, the second question, why, of course, you have to look at the White House, where the commander-in-chief, President Trump, has refused to acknowledge climate change as a problem for the United States. He denies the science of climate change and doesn't want to have the topic discussed. So the Pentagon, even though it's reporting on climate change damage to its own bases, has scrubbed the term climate change from its report on this damage and talks just about climate or extreme weather, or uses other euphemisms for climate change. So that's one problem that you have to deal with if you're in the Department of Defense and your commander-in-chief is a climate change denier.
And the risks are a lot larger than infrastructure, which I think is really the focus of your book. I mean, infrastructure is serious as it is because it means that the Pentagon cannot respond to national security risks. First, talk about the impact on, well, first of all, tell us, what do we mean by national security? I mean, national security can encompass a lot of different things. So what are the areas of national security that you really broadly cover in this book?
Well, thank you, Francesca. And my book looks at climate change as best I can from the Pentagon's perspective. That's what it's about. And I rely on interviews and documents from the Department of Defense and time spent at military institutions talking with people there. So I do my best to represent the perspective that I learned through this work. And from their perspective, national security is defending the United States from the threats to our survival and well-being. And from their perspective, the primary threats right now are China and Russia. But they see, looking into the future, that climate change will impede their ability to defend the nation from foreign threats. It will do so, first of all, by damaging infrastructure at home. We've discussed that. Also by creating disasters in this country, which will require a military response. The Department of Defense will have to deploy forces to deal with the aftermath of emergencies here in this country, as it did in 2017 after Hurricane Harvey in Houston and Irma in Florida, and especially Maria in Puerto Rico. In all of those, the military mobilized tens of thousands of troops to deal with the disasters that occurred as a result of those hurricanes. But the military also sees that climate change is going to create chaos around the world, that the kind of disasters we've seen here will affect other parts of the world probably in even stronger terms, because those other parts of the world may lack the ability, the capacities we have. In Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia, there'll be massive storms, droughts, and floods, fires, as we've seen in Australia. And this will create a massive chaos, pandemics, the collapse of nations, mass migrations. And this, they believe, will require constant U.S. military intervention abroad, dealing with small-scale conflicts, with terrorism, with pandemics. And in this way, divert their attention from what they see as the greater threat of China and Russia. And eventually, all of these things will add up together. That is, the disasters at home, the collapse of infrastructure, global chaos, to what I call an all hell breaking loose scenario in which the military will not be able to do any of its primary tasks because of climate change.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael Clare about his latest book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. So, yeah, you talk about climate change as a threat multiplier. What do you mean by a threat multiplier? Maybe we could take an example of, say, that very Asia-Pacific region that you are linking to, that you just spoke about.
Well, the term threat multiplier is one that comes from a group of retired military officers, part of something called the CNA Corporation from the Center for Naval Analysis, that did a very influential report in 2007 on climate change and U.S. national security. And they are the ones who came up with that term. And what they meant by that is that if you look around the world at countries in Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa, that are already on the edge of collapse because of poverty, because of corruption, because of resource scarcity, that when climate change intensifies, as it's already doing in those parts of the world, as it gets even worse, climate change will add to the pressures on weak states and push them over the brink into collapse, producing all this chaos and violence that they fear the most.
And actually, maybe a better example of that would be what you talk about with the devastation of the wheat harvest in Russia in 2010. I wonder if you could take us through that example and link it to what happened in the Middle East and the Arab Spring and then the subsequent breakdown of those countries.
Yes, this is an example that the military has studied very carefully. And to be clear, nobody says that climate change is the sole or necessarily the primary cause of the Arab Spring in 2011. But they do see that it was what they call a threat multiplier. And this begins with the fact that North Africa, in particular, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, those countries, Algeria, which were at the epicenter of the Arab Spring, depend very heavily on wheat, on bread, as a major source of food, especially for poor people. And these are countries also that had authoritarian governments, that had well-entrenched elites. Poor people were marginalized and abused. So there was a lot of hostility there to begin with. Then along came the summer of 2010, which was a series of severe droughts in Australia and China, and especially in Russia. Russia had the worst summer of fires that it ever experienced in its history in 2010. A quarter or a fifth of its wheat harvest was burned into smoke because of fires. The temperatures were incredible. And as a consequence, as a result of the damage to the wheat crop in Russia, President Putin, he was then prime minister, ordered a ban on Russian wheat exports. And as this made its way around the world, the price of bread doubled in North Africa. This was now in December 2010. And it created a crisis there for poor people as the price of food doubled overnight. And it sparked food riots first in Algeria, then in Tunisia and Egypt, and it spread throughout the Middle East. Other issues then joined in. Hatred of the entrenched regimes and the elites who didn't care about the poor. And so it became more of a political issue. But it started as food riots, and climate change definitely were a critical cause of the rise in the price of wheat at the start of the Arab Spring.
This is also part of what you call shockwaves. And before I get to that, I'm going to ask you about the ladder of escalation, because I think what's really So powerful in the way you present the issue in this book, Michael Clare, in All Hell Breaking Loose, is that you move from, I wouldn't say lower threats to the people experiencing them, but in global terms, more isolated effects to progressively more global effects. As shockwaves is the devastation of the wheat harvest in Russia in 2010 led to a whole cascade of problems across the globe. But tell us first, what is the ladder of escalation? Where do we start on it? And then where do we progressively go?
Yes, this is my expression. I harking back to the Cold War period when nuclear analysts talked about a ladder of escalation beginning with a very small crisis escalating into a bigger war and then a nuclear war and then all-out nuclear war ending in the Holocaust that would destroy us all. So I took this term and extended it to the climate era and talk about how we can expect to go from isolated climate crises to clusters of climate crises and to ever more severe conditions, which will lead to what I call an all hell breaking loose scenario in which these crises are occurring all over the world simultaneously, leading to global disorder and breakdown. So along that way, there will be a ladder of climate escalation from isolated disasters to clusters of disasters that lead to food spikes, food price spikes, like the one we saw in 2010 and 2011. I think we can expect to see more of those in the not-too-distant future. Australia, which is now on fire, is one of the world's major wheat producers, and I don't think we're going to see much wheat coming from Australia anytime soon. And I think we're going to see severe droughts in Africa and in Asia and other parts of the world creating this kind of shockwave that we saw in 2010 and 11. So what I mean by this ladder of escalation is isolated events leading to more and more severe crises and chaos.
Mm-hmm. You spoke about China and Russia before. Another area of great potential conflict, and here to bring in the national security issue very tellingly, is Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. And so talk about these two countries. Saudi Arabia sits in the world, in the middle of the world's climate furnace, as you say. What are the risks, the security risks that we face with Pakistan and Saudi Arabia confronting climate chaos?
Yes, indeed. As part of this process of escalation that I discuss, you're going to see states collapse as a result of climate change. That's already occurring in Africa, where countries in the Sahel region, the area south of the Sahara Desert, like Mali and Niger, are already facing disintegration because of food and water scarcity and fighting between different bands of people over what little water and land remains, and the government unable to survive on its own without outside forces. But these are small, relatively unimportant countries on the world map. But eventually, this kind of disintegration is going to face larger countries, richer countries, more important countries like Nigeria, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia. And when these countries face disintegration, this is going to pose a very serious challenge for the U.S. military and the U.S. national leadership. At what point do we intervene? In the case of Saudi Arabia, a major oil producer and a key ally of the United States, but a country that has virtually no water and no ability to produce food on its own, And as it gets hotter, its ability even to pump out oil will become hotter and hotter. And it could face an internal revolt like that which occurred in 2011 during the Arab Spring. Will the U.S. be forced to intervene there? That's an open question. Even more serious is the question of Pakistan. Pakistan is a very dubious ally of the United States, but does play a key role on the war in terrorism and is essential for supporting U.S. forces in Afghanistan. It is also a nuclear power, far more dangerous than Iran, because it already possesses nuclear weapons, perhaps 100 of them. And if Pakistan were to collapse, which is very easy to imagine, given its dependence on one major water supply, the Indus River, which could disappear for parts of the year because of climate change and the melting of the Himalayan glaciers. If Pakistan broke apart and some elements of the military with ties to jihadist organizations seized nuclear weapons, this almost certainly would prompt a U.S. military intervention. And then we'd be in a war in Pakistan with nuclear armed factions. This is a far more dangerous scenario than anything people are talking about with respect to Iran.
And wouldn't that bring in China and India as well? Because they also, to some degree, China's some regions and India depend on these Himalayan glaciers?
Any of these scenarios involving the rivers of the South Asia and East Asia is potentially dangerous in that respect. India also depends on the Indus River, or large parts of India depend on the Indus River. And if the Indus were to disappear for large parts of the year, it's not unlikely that India and Pakistan would fight over what rivers there were, especially if India were to dam some of the tributaries. Some of the tributaries of the Indus River lie in India-controlled Kashmir, which is a site of intense fighting right now. So this could spark a war between India and Pakistan that could become nuclear. Another river, the Brahmaputra, which combines with the Ganges River in Bangladesh, but is very crucial to India before that, arises in China, in the Himalayas. And China has threatened to dam that river and divert its waters if conditions in China deteriorate because of climate change and water scarcity. If that happened, it could prompt a war between China and India, and both of them possess nuclear weapons. So that could be a source of nuclear escalation. So you see how climate change could interact with pre-existing conditions and nuclear proliferation to spark a nuclear war.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Michael Clare about his new book, All Hell Breaking Loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. That's terrifying. And yet not the only threat. Talking about China, you say of the several billion people in the Asia-Pacific region, 80% of them live within 200 miles of the coast. Recently, we saw some updates to coastal flooding predictions as a result of the melting of, you know, the ice of the Arctic and Antarctic, which completely wiped out some of the largest cities in the world. So how is China thinking of dealing with this, and how does this how are they going to respond to this issue, and how is that going to increase the risks to our own national security?
Well, this is a very interesting question, Francesca. We don't really know exactly how Chinese leaders think in terms of the national security implications of climate change, the way we do about the U.S. There aren't the same kinds of documents that I was able to rely on in writing my book about the U.S. military's perspective on climate change. I haven't been able to find, at least in English, in public, equivalent documents about China's military, but they must be deeply worried about the same concerns that the U.S. military has about rising seas and extreme storms and drought, because China is more vulnerable even than the United States is to climate change. A very large portion of its population and industrial base is located very close to the Pacific Ocean at very low elevations, like Shanghai and other coastal cities. And these are bound to be devastated by rising seas and future storms. Also, China faces a threat from desertification. A large part of Western China is desert, and the desert is expanding. And water scarcity is a problem, too, for China. So they must know, their leaders must know, that as temperatures rise, China will be at risk, and that the military will be called upon again and again to deal with crises and emergency situations, disaster relief. So they must be aware of this and are planning for it. I believe that looking into the future, this might be something that could lead to collaboration between the U.S. and China, in that we both face the same threats to our respective national security. And it means that the forces of the U.S. and China are going to be far more busy defending their own countries against the ravages of rising seas than they're going to have time to fight against each other. So in this sense, there's a silver lining to all of this, in that it can allow for greater collaboration between the U.S. and China, possibly.
I'd like to get back to that point, but first, tell us a bit about this issue of global pandemics. I mean, we do know that just increased globalization threatens global pandemics, but you talk more specifically about the link to climate change, not only in the sense of expanding range of diseases, but also in the ability to respond to them.
Yes, climate change is going to have, from all accounts, is going to have a very significant impact on the potential for mass pandemics for a number of reasons. One, you mentioned, it is going to make the world hotter and in many areas more moist, especially in sea coast areas. And that's exactly the conditions that contribute to the spread of mosquitoes. And mosquitoes, of course, are a primary vector for diseases like malaria and the Zika disease. Both of these, among others, are going to spread more rapidly into temperate zones where they previously did not exist. Lyme disease is also spreading as a result of climate change. So you have that. Secondly, you have the concentration. More and more people are moving to the coasts because inland areas are becoming too hot and dry to grow crops. So farmers are abandoning the interior in China, in throughout Southeast Asia, and Africa, and in Latin America, Mexico, Central America, all these places, farmers are abandoning the countryside because it's becoming increasingly impossible to grow crops. And they're moving to the cities on the coasts, living in shanty towns and very packed, very close together, with very little health care and lacking proper sewage facilities. And the result is this also contributes to the spread of disease. And then you add the collapse of governmental facilities and the aftermath of storms, and this is the kind of conditions in which pandemics spread.
And, of course, pandemics and droughts and floods lead to mass migration events. You know, you just mentioned Central America. I mean, this is playing out right now on our southern border. Talk about the drought in Guatemala and what that, you know, how that is playing into the explosive politics of immigration in the U.S.
This is a very important question. Scholars who have spoken with immigrants or those who might immigrate to the United States find that migrants usually have many reasons to make the move. Typically, it's young men who are most mobile. In many cases, they're fleeing violence, but they're all fleeing poverty. And the primary cause of poverty in Central America today is the collapse of agriculture, the inability to grow crops and raise a family and make a living. And the reason why agriculture is collapsing in Central America and Mexico is because of rising temperatures and drought. And this is, of course, due to climate change. So climate change is an underlying factor in the migration of masses of people from Central America and Mexico into the United States. It's not the only factor, but it's a key underlying factor. And we should assume that this is going to become more pronounced as time goes on and global temperatures rise.
So you mentioned before that China may, you know, there may be a silver lining that we, that the world pulls back from military conflicts because they're just dealing with too many climate crises. But then there's the Arctic. The Arctic is opening up because of the loss of the sea ice. And, you know, ironically, Russia, the U.S., Europe, you know, China also, they're maybe very interested in exploiting the fossil fuel resources, which, of course, will make it all much worse, of the Arctic. You know, which way are we going to go? Are we going to go the way of the silver lining? Of course, you don't know. You don't have a crystal ball to consult. But what are your thoughts about poise between these two possibilities, between war over dwindling fossil fuel resources? What are the factors that will promote or inhibit that versus, you know, global cooperation to deal with the problem of climate change? What are the forces inhibiting or promoting that?
Well, I don't think I have to say to you or your listeners that this will depend to some degree on political conditions, how the national leadership in these countries view the situation in the future, what they see as their priorities. But my guess is that, or my sense is that the populations of the U.S. and Russia and China and India are going to become more and more exposed at a personal level, at a community level, to the ravages of climate change. I think we're seeing that today in California with the fires, in the southwest and the southeast with extreme drought and continuous heat waves, that people, as they become more aware at a personal level of the impact of climate change, they're going to demand action at the national level from their leaders. And I think the military, for its own reasons, the U.S. military and the Chinese military, for their own professional reasons, are going to take a stronger leadership role in all of this because they see that they can't carry out their duties without action on climate change. So I think in time, there will be a political shift towards greater collaboration to solve the problem and away from the brink of war. But how quickly that shift will occur, I can't say. We should be looking at Australia. Australia will be a very good case because it's so much like the United States. Right now, it has a conservative government that downplays the threat of climate change and favors the extraction of fossil fuels to prop up the economy. But as a result of the fires there, there appears to be a shift in public opinion towards greater emphasis on preventing more climate change. And maybe we'll see how this plays out.
Yes. And as you say, hopefully in time. Well, Michael Clare, your book is all hell breaking loose, The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. It is a spellbinding read. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I hope people found this interesting.
Michael Clare. For a link to his recent article in The Nation, How Rising Temperatures Increase the Likelihood of Nuclear War, go to writersvoice.net. Next up, an excerpt from our 2011 interview with Christian Parenti about his book, Tropic of Chaos. And on a lighter note, we review Hilary Davidson's new thriller, Don't Look Down. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. In 2011, I interviewed Christian Parenti about his book, Tropic of Chaos. It's a deep dive into the catastrophic conversion between climate change and global conflict. Let's listen back to an extended clip from that interview. Christian Parenti, welcome to Writer's Voice. The Tropic of Chaos. First, tell our listeners, what is the Tropic of Chaos?
The Tropic of Chaos is the belt of states around the mid-latitudes of the planet, that most of which lie between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. And it is also the region in which climate change is already expressing itself as political and religious and criminal violence increasingly. And the book is an explanation of how this crisis of climate-driven violence works.
You start your book with a really searing story of the murder of a tribal herdsman. Tell us that story.
The book opens with a story of Ekeru Lorimon, who was a Turkana pastoralist in northwest Kenya, and he had been killed the evening before in a cattle raid. And I use his death to unpack how climate violence works, and I try and understand the multiple levels of causality behind his death. So at one level, he was just killed in a cattle raid. Cattle raids are a traditional part of culture in the pastoralist corridor that stretches through Uganda, Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, Sudan. But in recent years, the cattle raiding has become much more violent. Part of the answer to why that is because the region is suffering one of the worst droughts it's seen in 60 years. And in northwest Kenya, all of the greenery that the animals would survive on is dead, except for on a narrow band along the rivers or around wells. And so the cattle economy, the pastoralist culture of the Turkana, is in profound crisis. So there's a climatological element, but then the other aspects that feed the violence are the legacy of the Cold War, which has throughout the global South basically littered the terrain with cheap weapons, men trained in violence, ripped up and battered economies, and traumatized populations. And in northwest Kenya, there are lots and lots of cheap guns. They flow out of Somalia, which is a failed state that was produced by one of the hot proxy wars that was a subset of the Cold War, a war between Ethiopia and Somalia, with the Soviet Union and Cuba supporting Ethiopia, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan supporting Somalia. That war ended in the collapse of Somalia. There hasn't been a functioning government there since, and Somalia hemorrhages guns out into the region. So there's cheap guns for people like Ekeru Lorimon to buy, and for the people who killed him, some Pokot raiders from the Karasuk Hills, they too have access to these guns. And then the third factor in it is neoliberal economic restructuring, or radical free market economic orthodoxy, which has been pushed on one state after another in the global South by the IMF and the World Bank. in response to the debt crisis that many countries have faced beginning in the late 1970s. The IMF and World Bank have forced a kind of economic restructuring that requires that in exchange for survival loans, governments reduce their participation in the economy. So in real concrete terms, that means in Kenya that the state doesn't provide as much assistance to pastoralists as it used to. So in the face of this drought, people like Ekuru Lorman and people like the Pequot Raiders who killed him, they can't turn to the state for veterinary services, for subsidized replenishment of their herds, or for, you know, government-subsidized work programs where they can get cash to survive. So they try and survive by turning to the gun. That's the one tool they have that's readily available. And they try to adapt to the extreme climate by stealing their neighbor's cattle or by driving their neighbors away from the few sources of water there are, seizing by force control of a water hole and guarding it, or seizing by force and policing and guarding with violence the banks of a river where you can farm a little and where you can keep your herds alive and water them. And so the traditional violence of raiding has become much, much more serious. There's higher casualties. There's massacres. I mean, we just had these reports coming out of South Sudan of a major massacre of up to possibly 600 people from a cattle raid. When there isn't cattle to raid, these raiding parties, they'll go out for weeks at a time raiding, and they'll raid buses and civilian traffic as well. And then the Kenyan army responds, or the Kenyan paramilitary police with helicopters and a counterinsurgency. The Ugandan army has crossed the border into Kenya. The Ugandan army has even bombed pastoralists from the air. And, the situation is very critical. There is essentially a state of war in a lot of northern Kenya and other parts of the pastoralist corridor. But it's not a war with two distinct sides to which there can ever be some sort of resolution or end. It's a society disintegrating into violence. And this combination of forces of the legacy of the Cold War, free market economic restructuring, and now the onset of anthropogenic climate change, I call this the catastrophic convergence, because climate change arrives in the global south on a stage preset for crisis by those two other existing problems, and this catastrophic convergence unfolds differently in different places around the planet.
Well, it's just what strikes me about what you're talking about is that the global south, where this has really been happening for a while and is so intense and the greatest impacts are being felt, that there's blowback. I mean, you make a point that the global north and the global south are connected, and we're beginning to see these neoliberal policies bringing down economies here and in Europe. And we're also seeing the whole influx of climate refugees. Could you talk a little bit about how this convergence is now drawing the entire world into its net?
My argument about the catastrophic convergence, or just the way that climate change drives violence, in the global south, it pushes states towards civil war, towards state failure. It fuels banditry, it fuels zealotry and general disorganization. In the global north, it's fueling increased surveillance, increased border militarization, the rise of a kind of climatologically driven authoritarianism. I mean, it's not only climate change, but just that there's an increasingly a small element of causality behind border militarization, increased policing and surveillance of civilian populations in the global north. And also the Pentagon is, and other Western militaries are planning to engage, address this problem through a program of open-ended counterinsurgency and counterterrorism on a global scale. And that's in their documents where they address climate change. And they take the climate science very seriously, and they see a future of civil war and state failure that they're going to have to respond to. So, but the first stages of this crisis in the global north express themselves not as disintegration, a weakening of the state, but a hardening of the state. So you see that on the border in Arizona, where the government passes AB 1070, this law that basically strips Arizona citizens of their Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure in the name of stopping and deporting immigrants. And a lot of the xenophobic right in the Southwest is increasingly articulating its anti-immigrant agenda in terms of an environmental crisis. You know, people are acutely aware of the fact that these Sunbelt cities, many of them, do not have enough water, that there are not enough resources. And so this is leading to a kind of a mentality of the armed lifeboat. And there are, you know, for example, FAIR, the Federation of American Immigration Reform, which is the main anti-immigrant lobby in the United States, has set up a group called Progressives for Immigration Reform, which young climate activists have protested and called out as a front group that is essentially trying to appeal to Greens and environmentalists to get them on board with a racist anti-immigrant agenda, which is fundamentally about hardening the regime of surveillance and policing and incarceration domestically in the United States.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our guest is Christian Parenti, and we're talking about what he calls the catastrophic convergence between climate change, violence, and predatory capitalism that's destroying many societies in the global South and affecting us as well. As you say, immigration, terrorism, counterinsurgency become this kind of toxic brew. Could you also talk about what is driving immigration from Mexico, or was? Because actually now with these draconian laws and the decrease in economic opportunity here, that's lessened a bit, but maybe not for always.
Yeah, another thing that's caused a decrease in immigration from Mexico is the economic slump here, and also the rising demand for agricultural products from China. I mean, you know, China is basically the buyer of first and last resort for much of the global South. So there was that article in the New York Times based on Douglas Massey's research about immigration, and the, you know, they used the example of aguave and tequila, and Asia is the market which is now, you know, buying this tequila and driving up prices. So it's actually helping to stabilize the rural economy in some parts of Mexico. But to the extent that people, which they do in massive numbers, still migrate north, I try to unpack how much of it is climate driven and sort of think about how you define a climate refugee. There are some climate refugees who are very clearly driven out of their homes by floods or hurricanes. But they're, more often than not, climate is merely one factor among others that drive people off the land. So in Juarez, I met some Tarahumara Indians who had left the Sierra Madre because in part drought had made farming impossible for them. And, you know, it was a combination of economic policies and these climatological conditions forced them into Juarez. Another guy I met on the south bank of the Rio Grande was this fisherman who had been driven away from the coast of Michoacan, where he was a fisherman, by an El Nino event in the late 90s that caused a toxic algae bloom, drove away the fish. He had one season that was just a total loss, and he couldn't turn to the state for assistance because neoliberal economic restructuring, radical free market economics, have really transformed the Mexican economy and the role of the Mexican state within it. So all of the old semi-socialist supports that the Mexican state once provided for fishermen and farmers have been rolled back. So he had to take out private loans to tide him over. He couldn't pay them back. He lost his boat and his gear. And he went from being a small proprietor to just a wage laborer. He eventually moved north to the U.S. He gets a job as a roofer. Then he gets deported. And when I met him, he was in Juarez trying to figure out how he was going to come up with the money to get a coyote to take him across the border. And he was saying, you know, one of the only ways to make money around here is to get involved in the drug trade, and I don't want to do that. So you can see, is he an economic refugee? Yes. Is he a climate refugee? Yes, in part. And then he finds himself in a position where he could very easily become fodder in this drug war. He could become, you know, the human material of the narco-driven chaos in northern Mexico, which is really, I mean, it's not a drug war. That almost gives it a sense of coherence that it doesn't have. Like, there are two sides fighting each other. There are multiple sides, and law and order has completely broken down in Juarez. I think in 2009, I believe two murders were prosecuted in Juarez. So that means, you know, if you want your neighbor assassinated, you can hire some teenager to do it for $100, and the chances are very, very slim that you will be caught or prosecuted for it. Mm-hmm. So the violence there is way beyond people fighting over drug turf.
Mentioning the drug war, there was an article in the New York Times about the Brazilian Northeast, which you also look at in your book, Christian Parenti, the book Tropic of Chaos. The article was about how the drug war is taking over the northeast of Brazil, and there was no mention of the climate crisis that is affecting the northeast. You went there, you talked to people there, you also found some very positive solutions. I wonder if you could talk about what's happening in the Brazilian northeast and what are some positive ways that people are dealing with it.
In the northeast of Brazil, I found a community of farmers who, you know, I mean, it was almost just like made to order. It was this parable for what adaptation involves. So they lived in the semi-arid northeast in a valley with a road that went through the middle of the valley. On one side of the road, there was a small village, and the people there owned their land, and they were using a form of mixed tree and vine crop organic agriculture that they called agroecological forestry, or the system. And it was, you know, involved low tech kind of irrigation. For example, you know, using a single plastic water bottle with a tiny hole in the cap upside down, strapped to the side of a small fruit tree so that it would drip down and just irrigate that tree. Techniques of water harvesting, like building an underground dam, essentially a wall that's buried underground that hits bedrock, that acts much like a regular dam would by keeping moisture in the soil above it. So it's a way of capturing moisture in the soil. All sorts of really ingenious techniques that produce this valuable organic produce for which they get a premium. But the problem with this is that it takes several years to get this system up and running. On the other side of the road was a cattle ranch that was owned by an Italian who was not in the area. And this community needed more land to survive. So they had organized with the Movimento Sem Terra, the MST, the Landless People's Movement in Brazil, which has very famously had great success over the last 20 years and redistributed land to tens of thousands of Brazilians. And with the guidance of the MST, this community organized. I mean, the MST doesn't have people there. They became the MST. The community became the MST. And they took part of this cattle ranch, and they were occupying it. And I hung out with them for a few days, and it only came out like right before I left that I realized, wait a minute, on the side of the road they were occupying, they were using the kind of traditional modern version of farming, monocropping, clearing away the trees rather than planting around them, exposing the soil to erosion and the wind and the sun, and using pesticides and artificial fertilizers, which has the beyond the environmental damage, has the risks of driving them into debt. And I was like, why are you doing this, you know, method of farming over here that you spent 2 days criticizing, essentially? And they're like, well, you know, and they were kind of like embarrassed by it. They were like, look, you know, we can't actually, until we get title to this land, I mean, we could get thrown out of here any day by the police. They could come in and crack our heads open. Until we get title to this land, we can't afford to invest the time necessary to restore it and, you know, nurture it for 4 to 5 years before we make any money. We have to make some money now in case we lose the land tomorrow. So we're planting these monocrops in, you know, with chemicals and the kind of modern fashion. And so to my mind, that really showed how social justice, the redistribution of land, the protection of, you know, the redistribution of wealth to poor people, particularly in the global south, the redistribution of land from big landowners to small landowners is a prerequisite for a technological change that is about restoring humanity's relationship to the soil, that you cannot expect there to be some kind of environmental balance if there isn't also social justice, that the two are inseparable.
Christian Parenti talking with Writer's Voice in 2011 about his book, Tropic of Chaos. In preparation for this episode, I came across a 2017 post by Parenti in Jacobin, talking about the consequences to us if we fail to act strongly now on the climate crisis. We'll link to that piece at writersvoice.net. Well, when the news about the climate apocalypse all gets too overwhelming for me, I escape into crime fiction. And that's why a week ago, amid the Australian fires and Trump's elimination by fiat of a major regulation protecting our waterways from toxic pollution, I picked up the newest thriller from best-selling author Hilary Davidson, Don't Look Down. It's the second in her Shadows of New York series, and it is a page-turner. Set in Manhattan, with many shout-outs to that fair city, Don't Look Down delves into what happens when Joe Griever, the successful young CEO of a makeup company, is blackmailed about having been trafficked as a teenage prostitute. Someone gets killed, and Joe gets a bullet in her arm. All the evidence points to Joe as the killer, but NYPD Detective Sharon Sterling isn't so sure. There are enough plot twists to keep any thriller aficionado engaged right until the end. Another nice note, the book references social justice issues like gentrification and police violence against African Americans, and some of its main characters, including Detective Sterling and her partner, are people of color. It's heartening to see white authors mainstreaming diversity. Kudos to Hilary Davidson for a terrific read. Go to writersvoice.net to find out what's coming up in the next few weeks on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.